early days, I think before we'd even started the company, one woman we interviewed, she said, I know this is going to be really hard. So if ever you feel like giving up, can you just call me and I'll find somebody else to work on this? And I was just like, oh my gosh, like we have to do this. Like that we are given a gift of this incredible opportunity, this idea we came up with, and all these women who are willing to participate. I mean, in our first clinical study, there was no benefit to the patient. It was purely data collection for us. And we still have women lining up to be in that study. And I just find that really moving.
Hello, everyone. My name is Christine Minotto. I'm the director of the UCSF Rosamond Institute at the University of California, San Francisco. And welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. Today, we're talking to Holly Rockweiler, the CEO and co-founder of Medora. Medora is developing and marketing a medical device solution for vaginal dryness. Vaginal dryness affects millions of women in the United States. It can occur in postmenopause or after cancer treatment. There are many causes, but one thing that many women with the condition have in common is that they have trouble talking about it. Holly would like that to change. Holly worked at Boston Scientific before joining the Stanford Biodesign Program, where she and her co-founder narrowed down from hundreds of unmet needs to focus on vaginal dryness. The gold standard is pharmaceutical therapy, but Medora provides a non-hormonal option, a medical device that provides significant relief after only weeks of use. Enjoy the talk, and if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. One more thing. Come join us to our 6th annual Rosamond Symposium on June 19th here at UCSF Mission Bay Campus. Our speakers include John Grudelors, CEO of Hillrom, Dr. T.P. McKinsey of UCSF, who performed the world's first stem cell transplant to a fetus last summer. Also featured this year is Stan Rowe, CEO of Next Biomedical, a partnership with Deerfield Management, where Deerfield has put aside up to $275 million to this project. Check out this year's lineup at our website, rosamondinstitute.org. Welcome, Holly. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I thought it would be good to start for, you started Medora, but you have quite a lot of experience before you started Medora. And so how, you went to Washington University to study biomedical engineering, and can tell us how you make that decision and how you transition to where you are today.
Yeah, great question. So I went to WashU, and I actually was undecided engineering when I started there. So I thought I knew I wanted to be an engineer because pretty much as a student in high school and younger, being good at math and science, every teacher told me, you should be an engineer. But I never knew what that really was. Even though my dad's an engineer, I just didn't understand it. But I was like, okay, well, I do like math and science, so I should do that. And so when I got to WashU, they had kind of the first year of classes is pretty much the same across all engineering. But I also took a survey class that gave us kind of a day or week introduction to each discipline of engineering. And I was always interested in biomedical engineering. I didn't know a lot about it. My dad was a civil engineer, so that made sense to me, like bridges and things. But it wasn't until, I got into that intro class that I was like, oh, this is really exciting. I can use math to describe health problems. Like, whoa, this is a thing. And I just felt really excited. And part of it also was a process of elimination. I talked to other people who were in different kinds of engineering. And I remember one student, I think she was a junior who was in civil engineering. And she was like, if you get really excited about walking over concrete, this is civil engineering's for you. And I was like, okay, it's not for me.
How about concrete every day?
Exactly. I was like, I don't really pay any attention to that. So it just started to fall into place. I feel really like it was kind of, I don't know, opportunity was there, but it was a little bit of luck, too, of finding the right place. So I didn't really feel like I understood what biomedical engineering was, though, even until I was a junior. It was a lot of, chemistry, physics, math, kind of standard classes.
Things that you start to understand in your junior year? Is it because you take more major?
Yeah, we finally got to take more classes in our discipline. And we had this, you know, year-long class called Quantitative Physiology, and that was really hard, but it was really exciting because it was, again, kind of, you know, figuring out the equations to describe, like, an action potential in a cell, and I was, like, super nerding out. And I remember coming home to my roommate, who's also a biomedical engineer, and being like, this is it. This is totally it. This is why we're here. So I couldn't even do those equations now, but I loved it at the time.
It's funny. My son was asking me, why do I have to remember all this formula? Will I even be using it? I was like, well, you never know.
The good thing is you can always go back and look them up.
Yeah. So and then you decided to go to graduate school right after your undergraduate.
Yeah. So I went to WashU had a cool program at the time where you could do a master's in only or a combined bachelor's and master's in only 5 years. So it was a really cool opportunity. I thought I wasn't sure if I wanted to do it, but after my junior year and one of my jobs, I was kind of working for someone who was going back to school part-time while she was also a mom. And I just saw how hard her life was. And I was like, you know, I think I should just get this out of the way. And so I decided to do it right away. And again, the program at WashU was really cool because I could accelerate a lot of what I did. So yeah, it was grad school, but just really a continuation of my undergrad.
Do you have to focus on certain things? I mean, what was your thesis? I mean, being not a PhD, but I'm sure master's still have that.
Yeah, we actually, at that time, there was no required thesis, but you had to pick a discipline within biomedical engineering because it's so broad, as you know. So I focused on bioelectricity. And so the lab that I worked on was working on different brain-computer interfaces. And that was research I remember learning about when I was like in high school, thinking that was so cool. So I helped out in that lab. I didn't have a thesis project, but it was a really cool opportunity to see what the cutting edge of science was really looking like.
And now a lot of people are talking about this whole brain interface.
Yeah, it's still around. It's still doing really well. That lab is still doing fantastically and connected with a lot of other labs who are doing the same thing across the world.
Yeah, so you decided after that, then time for you to get a job.
Totally, yeah. So I, while I was between my fourth and fifth years at WashU, I interned at Boston Scientific because I was always interested in medical devices and bioelectricity lent itself really well to the kind of pacemaker and ICD world. And so I had the opportunity to do an internship at Boston Scientific in their research department, and it was really cool. I was just like, yes, this is what I've been studying for. I mean, I was learning everything brand new every day, it felt like, but it was really an exciting opportunity. And so out of that internship, I got a job offer. So I was able to go back for my fifth year knowing I already had a job, which was a really
nice.
Lucky place to
be. Were you
be.
Like slacking off the last 2 months?
I don't think so. Probably. I don't know. It's hard to remember. Uh-huh. But yeah, so then after graduating, then I went back full time and pretty much picked up the project I had started when I was an intern. So that was really cool to be able to hit the ground running. And then I worked there for 5 years.
So in that 5 years you were there, what do you find that is something that is like, wow, that was something that I make an impact?
Good question.
Because I think when you work for a large company, being an entry level, it's hard to see. But I'm sure it's really impactful. But
yeah, I think actually you kind of touch on why I ended up leaving is that it was hard for me to feel that impact from what I was doing. So in the beginning, everything was new. It was really exciting. And I mean, what the company does is really great work. And I was working with all of these people who were so accomplished. Almost everybody had a PhD. And it just was a really great introduction to our industry. And one day a year, they had this day called Patient or Quality Days, where they invited patients to come in. It was kind of in the expo center, and we all got to go and hear the patient's stories. And, like, it was my favorite day of the year. I, like, brought my tissues, and I sat in the front row. Like, it was so fun. And I realized that, well, why does it only have to be one day of the year? Like, why can't I connect with patients more often? And it was really hard to do that in a larger organization. I mean, you're very much, I don't want to say pigeonholed, but you're very much kind of assigned to your role. Right. And when I tried to branch out to other things, I said, oh, that's not your job. That's marketing's job. That's the salesperson's job, et cetera. So I realized, like, it wasn't necessarily a good fit for me because I wanted to do more than just one thing. And so that's part of the reason why I ended up leaving there.
Yeah. So when you were at Boston Scientific for 5 years, what was your role?
Yeah, so I was a research scientist, and I was working in the cardiac rhythm division, which is the group that makes the pacemakers, ICDs, and cardiac rhythm, the CRTs, the cardiac resynchronization therapy devices. And so my group was working on next generation algorithms for those products. So basically, I say to my mom, it's like a new app for your iPhone, like something that's going to come out in a couple years to make your phone that much more exciting. And so our group was working on making the device more automatic, mm-hmm. which is a really cool experience, too. I think that industry is so well established. I mean, they've been doing telemedicine for, 20 years with a lot of the stuff they've been doing. You know, it's good to see the rest of healthcare catching up. So there is a lot to learn. And my specific project involved making the device be able to identify when it was causing a side effect for a patient and then fix itself. So prior to that, patients had to come in for an extra doctor's appointment. They had to call a rep from Boston Scientific to help reprogram the device to avoid this side effect. And we figured out a way to make it fix itself, yeah. which was really cool. What was challenging was how long it took to get that moving. And what my eyes were really open to was, probably I was a little naive, but the realities of running a big company like that, spreading resources across different departments, our project got started and stopped multiple times. And so it was really frustrating to me, who I was here and I was excited to make an impact. And then to be told, oh, we're going to stop your study. I was like, okay. Meanwhile, the company would be acquiring all these other exciting startups. And I was like, okay.
I wanted to be over there.
Exactly. If I want to do cutting-edge research, maybe I'm not supposed to do it from inside the company. Okay. So that was all kind of feeding into why I ended up leaving.
So you went to do your Stanford Biodesign program.
Yeah, that's when I ended up, or that was my next step mm-hmm. after Boston. And I feel really lucky that I came across the program also. So I was living in Minnesota. And I had met someone who was an alum of the Stanford program, and I was like, oh my God, that kind of thing exists? Like, that sounds so cool. I don't know anything about that. And at the time, too, I didn't know what I was really looking for. I just knew what I didn't like mm-hmm. and what
That's
I wanted
good to
do
know.
More of. Yeah, so it was, again, maybe process of elimination. That might be how I work, I guess. So I was thinking, like, actually a mentor of mine used to say or says, if you don't like the results you're getting, try something that's the total opposite. So I was like, okay, what's the opposite of this? I know I want to stay in medical devices, but a startup might be the total opposite of this. Uh-huh. I know nothing about that. I didn't know a single person who worked for a startup. Again, I was
none of your family.
None of my family. And, growing up in the Midwest, that sounded like a very risky thing. Even my parents were like, you have a great job. You have great benefits. What are you doing? But it was like, okay, well, this biodesign program is really respected. It sounds amazing. I know someone who went through it. I kind of informationally interviewed him, and I was like, yes, I want to do this. And frankly, it'd be a good way to figure out if I like the startup world.
Mm-hmm. And you got to move to the West Coast.
Exactly.
I bet.
Yeah. At the time, I was like, well, I love Minnesota. We'll see what California's like. I might not like it. I did. Spoiler alert. But yeah, it was a great way to, dip my toe in the water to see, like, what is that really like? Uh-huh. It was a big culture change, but in the right direction. It was really exciting.
So you were doing that in what year was that?
So I started the fellowship in 2013.
Okay. So the whole year of 2013 you were working on. And what was your project? I mean, every year they pick a different theme. So what's that theme for that year?
Yeah, our year, it was a focus on urology and nephrology.
Okay.
So urinary systems and kidneys.
Okay, that's interesting. So you've done that part, and then from that you came out with this technology with but that you're starting now. Well, not starting, you already started with Medora.
Exactly, yeah. So
that's quite different from urology.
It is.
So maybe you can tell us more about what is Medora.
Sure, yeah. So Medora is a new device to treat vaginal dryness. And so we're a women's health company really trying to change the paradigm for a condition that's overlooked but affects millions of women. It's something that today is really only treated with pharmaceutical products that have a lot of side effects and risks associated with them. So we met women in the program and realized, one, what a problem this was for them, but then two, how big of a market this really was, how many women were really struggling. And so that's why we decided to develop what we are developing at Medora. And how we got there from urology, it does feel kind of like a step away, but it was pretty natural progression because so in our clinical immersion, we were in the urologist's office. We saw a lot of different things, but it was mostly in men's health. Mm-hmm. And our program advisors said, you know, don't forget about the women. You need to go see the urogynecologists for that.
Oh, so women go to urogynecologists. They don't see
more urologists. Often. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. So when we went to those offices, that's where we saw kind of a whole host of women's health problems. And, you know, those started to make it onto our list of unmet needs. And vaginal dryness was one of them. And as you know, with the program, you wind up with a list of like hundreds of unmet needs, and you spend the rest of the year filtering that list down, doing diligence on the unmet needs until you figure out the right problem for you to work on.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, only recently I heard about the vaginal dryness, like literally maybe 2 years ago. And you don't hear that very often unless you have the problem, obviously. But then do you think there's more awareness now, or where are we on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do. I think, like, you know, I mean, I'm probably very biased, but, you know, when we started this, you know, 4.5 years ago, yeah, nobody was talking about this at all. Not enough people are talking about it yet, but it's changed a lot. I think women are just getting more comfortable. There's been more attention in the women's health space in general. So there's a term out there called femtech, which I don't love, but it at least is drawing a lot of attention to women's health needs. And there's been a lot of interest in reproductive health and things like that. So I think that's, as a society, we're just getting more comfortable talking about women's health needs. I think in the past, and maybe still true, women feel like they have to take care of everyone else before they take care of themselves. And that leads us not to talk about problems that are affecting women. And that's changing when we have more women's voices that are out there being heard in, you know, podcasts like this. But also, because there's been more attention, there's also some interesting, you know, products that are making claims about improving this condition of vaginal dryness. And while they don't necessarily have FDA approval for what they're saying, they're still doing a lot of PR. And so there's a lot of clinics out there that offer vaginal rejuvenation, and that's a very broad term, but the good news is that's kind of creating a float all boats marketing. It's increasing awareness about the condition. So like you, I didn't know anything about vaginal dryness. I never even heard of it before meeting women in the program. And so one of our biggest messages from the company and me personally is like, we just need to convince women that, first of all, it's okay to talk about this. We want to elevate the dialogue and say, you don't have to live with this. You don't have to be ashamed of it. Right. There's millions of women who have this problem, and there's options.
Right.
We're coming up with a great new one, but in the meantime, there are things you can use that'll help along the way.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. For some people who don't know vaginal dryness, what is it as a patient? How does that impact their life?
Yeah, so it's a lot like dry eye or dry mouth or like a sore throat. I always say this, but it's, you know, a part of your body that you don't really think about until, you know, you have strep throat and it hurts every time you swallow. So for women with vaginal dryness, it typically affects women who are postmenopausal either from natural menopause or from a chemical menopause, for instance, from cancer treatments or surgical menopause. And so that means that the vaginal tissue just becomes dry. It becomes thin, very fragile, and then that can lead to a lot of quality of life symptoms, but also real medical sequelae. So from a quality of life perspective, it can feel, you know, like sandpaper. And women have told us that they have difficulty washing and wiping and don't want to wear jeans anymore because it's just so uncomfortable, or can't ride a bike. From a medical standpoint as well, you can see increased rates of urinary tract infections, yeast infections, et cetera, because of the change that happens to the microbiome in the vaginal tissue. And so it leads to, you know, obviously daily discomfort. And then for many women, it also leads to pain with intercourse, which is another topic that's difficult to talk about, but very common. And so it's important to note that it's not just about sex, mm-hmm. but that's one very important component of this.
So right now, you mentioned there's a few options. And of course, Madura, you know, technology would be better. And can you tell us more, like, what those options are and how Madura technology would be better?
Yeah, the current landscape of FDA-approved products include the over-the-counter products, which are, you know, lubricants and moisturizers. So that's kind of what everyone thinks of when you think of this problem. Just like with dry eye, you think, oh, can't you just use eye drops? And sure, for a really mild case, that probably works great. And same story for vaginal dryness. However, when you start to have more moderate to severe symptoms, these products are really inadequate. And from our user interviews, you know, we heard a lot from women about how poor the user experience is as well. It's, you know, this kind of goopy mess that they have to deal with.
Right.
And they just wish they could get their old, you know, lubrication back. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the over-the-counter option.
It's funny, you know, people probably think it, like, what's a big deal? But just imagine you have to do that every day.
You have to do that every day, multiple times a day. And to be blunt, what one woman told us too is, like, can you imagine what a mood killer that is to have to keep squirting that on while you're having, you know, intercourse with your partner? It's terrible.
Yeah.
And it's cold. And it's gross. So I think that, you know, yeah, there's a lot there's a lot missing from what those products can offer. I mean, I'm glad that they're there. And again, it's something that helps provide immediate relief, but it's a more of a Band-Aid type solution. So on the kind of opposite end of the spectrum, the medical gold standard is prescription hormone replacement therapy. And that really hasn't changed in the last 30, 40 years. It's a good solution in that what's causing the dryness in the first place is a loss of estrogen. However, there's a lot of concerns with hormone use for specific patient populations and for a lot of women. So the hormone replacements can come in a lot of different forms. You can take, you know, an oral pill. There can be local creams that you use, or rings or tablets. So there's a lot of different kind of delivery methods, but the substrate is still the same. And so the challenge is that there was a huge study called the Women's Health Initiative that happened in the early 2000s that looked to see, you know, at that time, hormone replacement therapy was being prescribed left and right for all the symptoms of menopause, like hot flashes and weight gain and memory loss. And it was thought that it could be protective against osteoporosis, breast cancer, and heart disease. So the NIH did this huge study called the Women's Health Initiative, where they systematically looked at that in hundreds and hundreds of patients. The study had to be stopped early because they found a higher rate of breast cancer and cardiovascular risks in the hormone-using group. So what that's led to is a huge pendulum shift by society to basically, like, whoa, mm-hmm. hormones are scary. We shouldn't use them. Now, that I actually think that that's quite extreme, that mm-hmm. for the right patients, hormones can be a great option. But there's a lot of women who feel really uncomfortable about it, right. either because of their health history or because, you know, they have a friend who this happened to and they just don't want to touch this. And I think it also kind of fits with where kind of we're going as a society when it comes to wellness. I mean, people are trying to avoid chemicals in their soaps and cosmetics. Right. And, you know, many women we talked to said they didn't even want to use the lubricant products because they have parabens in them, for example. And so there's just this movement to try to get to more natural approaches. And so that's where Medora comes in. Our device is used in the home and can recreate the natural lubrication pathway. So it's a woman's own personal endogenous lubrication returning. Mm-hmm. And what women in our trial have told us is that it's night and day difference from using an over-the-counter lubricant. They can tell, mm-hmm. you know, it's their own lubrication. It feels much better. It feels much more normal. And they don't have to worry about any of the side effects associated right. with the hormones. And one thing I forgot to mention is that there's groups of women who are actually contraindicated from using hormones, so meaning they're not allowed to. And one big group of them is breast cancer survivors. They have some of the worst symptoms of vaginal dryness because of the cancer treatments they've been through. And then they can't yeah. use the gold standard. So they're forced to get by with the over-the-counter products, which they also don't like. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of women use coconut oil or yeah. something like that. And so we want a product that can, you know, solve this problem for them and for anyone else who's looking to avoid hormones.
So how does your product work?
Yeah, so our device uses ultrasound, and then it's used completely externally. So it can work naturally with the body to restore that lubricating mechanism. It's a daily maintenance therapy in the beginning, and then it's a daily therapy in the beginning, and then you move down into a maintenance dose after mm-hmm. that of just a few times a week.
Okay. So then from your patient study, how long does it take before they see their result?
Yeah, so in our early feasibility work, we saw that women saw results within the first 1 to 2 weeks. They saw their best results after 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so that tells us that, you know, you have to invest a little bit in the beginning, but that improvement that we saw in that study was equivalent to what the hormones have shown in their trials as well.
So, yeah, now it's like changing subject a little bit, and you've done good, you know, successful raising some money to fund Medora, and maybe you can share with us a little bit about, you know, your lesson learned, the challenges that you face when you raise money. Being a women's product, sometimes, you know, because oftentimes probably you see a lot of male investors, and here you are telling them about this problem, then probably, like, what's their reaction?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a lot of personal growth for me. You know, in the beginning when we first started, I think I didn't come right out and say it. I would say, oh, we're working on a quality of life product. I was a little sheepish about it. But that's totally changed. Now I've realized, like, if I can't talk about it, you know, like just like I'd talk about diabetes or heart disease, like no one else is going to feel comfortable. So I feel totally comfortable, probably to the, you know, my friends probably don't love hearing about it as often as they do. But
I think it's good because that will bring the awareness.
I agree. I totally agree. And so, you know, you're right. Often when pitching to raise funds, it's a room full of middle-aged or older men. And, you know, to their credit, I've never had any really negative, you know, experience with that. What I think that I've heard from other women or other people in women's health products, for instance, like breast pumps, they have had negative experiences. And so I don't know if this is true or not, but I kind of assume that a lot of people in the audience are in the age range where their sexual partner may be experiencing this. So that perhaps helps Medora a little bit. People have some awareness of the problem. Yeah. So, and again, credit to people being willing to talk about it. So, you know, a couple of the people that have joined the company recently as our employees who are men said that one of their first stops when they were, you know, thinking about applying was to talk to the women in their lives, you know, their wives or their sisters or whoever about, like, is this a real problem? What's this like? And so, thank you to all the women out there who are willing to talk about it.
I'm surprised that Oprah has not even talked about this.
I know. Do you know her?
No.
I really would love to talk to her about it.
One thing that, you know, now that you've done Medora for a few years, looking back, what are the things that you know now that you did not know then? And then is something that you feel like it takes time to get there and you cannot, you know, leapfrog it. Sometimes you have to go through it. What are those?
Gosh, how much time do we have? I think I have a lot.
That's good. That means you've been learning.
Yeah, I think, it's daily, honestly. You know, I think, and part of that's good. Like we were talking about the naivete piece of it that helps keep you going. If I, you know, think I knew back then what I know now, I don't know that I would have so eagerly started the company, but I'm really glad that I did. I mean, I don't have any regrets about that. So I think I had a protective naivete in place. Let's see. I think I've really learned a lot about human interaction, and I think that that's been not something I expected. I mean, I've learned a lot about women's health. I've learned a lot about the medical device industry. I've learned a lot about startups. But I've realized how much of, like, my daily work has to do with making sure the team is working well together. And a lot of my teammates are also doing that same thing. And the consultants and the, you know, contractors we're working with and the manufacturers, it's like, wow, people. People at the end of the day, you know, that's how this all gets done. And so
you didn't think of that when you were, say, at Boston Scientific, because you're working with people as well.
I was, but I think I was in an individual contributor role. So I was just kind of doing my thing, talked to my manager and my project leader, and that was pretty much it. Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know, I guess maybe I thought there was some magic that happens that makes things go. But it's a lot of making sure people feel empowered in their own work and feel like they're making a contribution. And I think that that's been a really rewarding part about this job, because I think I never saw myself as a CEO. I don't really like a lot of attention. So I'm happy to let other people step up and, you know, have the limelight. But what I do like is having a great team and finding great people to bring onto that team and again, working with our patients too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Things that you learn from the fundraising is always a dreadful thing for a lot of people, but it's important.
Yeah, I think one thing about fundraising that I like to tell others who are fundraising is that, you know, everyone says fundraising is hard. And when I heard that, I was like, okay, whatever. Like, all of this is hard. Like, what's hard about fundraising for a type A person is that it's not something you can control. And so it's hard in a way that, like when you're in college and your homework's hard, you can stay up all night and you can get it done. It doesn't work that way with fundraising. You can stay up all night. That's not going to get you anywhere. And so I think learning also how best to present this, because one of my friends who's also a startup entrepreneur said is like, a key thing I had to really change in my mind that sounds totally obvious is that, you know, I would come out and talk about the need and talk about our patients and talk about, you know, what this means for them. And that's all well and good. You know, it's healthcare. That's what motivates me. But investors want to know how they're going to turn $1 into $10. It doesn't matter in what industry. And so they're investors. They're not philanthropists. So the kind of, you know, medical story around it's important to know why this is impactful. But you really have to focus on the economics. Why is this a good investment for them? And I think that's a continuous journey for me to remember to talk about that, because that's not how I think. But in that audience, that's important. And I think another thing I've learned, too, is how to quickly change what the angle at which I pitch depending on the audience. So if it's a medical audience, I can go real deep on the data, real deep on FDA terminology and process and where we are in that stuff. But if it's, you know, a tech investor, they just want to know, how are we going to start selling this? So what's the fastest way we can get into the market and how are we going to market it? And so that's, I think, something that I've learned how to be more perceptive to what the audience's background is. And then sometimes you don't know and you're pitching to a big group. So you have to kind of try to hit each category and then hope you get a question in an area and you can show, oh yeah, I know a lot about the science. Oh yeah, I know a lot about the marketing plan. Oh yeah, I know a lot about the regulatory strategy.
Okay. So do you get like tech investors invested?
We do have some, yeah. I think we have a couple investors who actually were entrepreneurs themselves, made it big, mm-hmm. and now want to invest in healthcare to give back. As they said, so that's
kind of
cool.
I hope it's not just giving back. I'm sure that they...
yeah, I think it's still an investment, and I know that it's going to be successful, so
but it feels better.
Yeah.
To invest in something, not make an impact, I think.
Exactly, yeah. And I think there's just a lot of, you know, a lot of enthusiasm right now for investing more in women's health and women-led companies, and I'm really grateful for that because I think that's really helped Medora.
Yeah, no, I think that's one thing that what you're doing, it's like also bring awareness. It helped me to know that there's, you know, this area that needs that I'm not aware of. And when we think about women's health, you know, people tend to think about breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so many ramifications of breast cancer after you survive breast cancer.
Absolutely.
And I think people tend to forget about that. And so for people who are listeners who are might be interested in your product and learn more, where should they get their information?
The best place to go is our website. So www.medora.com. That's spelled just like Madonna, but with two R's instead of two N's. And on there, you can see, you know, our Twitter, and you can follow us, and you can also sign up for a newsletter as well. And so when we are looking to do clinical trials, we can send out an email to that list. And if you're in the area that we need a patient to enroll, then maybe we could work together. Otherwise, you can watch our progress there.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. So you raise seed funding, and then you're raising your Series A. It's almost done there. What's next? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. We are nearly finished with our Series A raise, which has been a really exciting time because prior to this, we've raised seed rounds, which were also very exciting, but the money comes in a little bit slower pace. And so we would raise a little, do a little work. Now with our Series A, you know, it's a big chunk of money and we can finally put the train on the track, so to speak. We've been talking about where we want to go for a long time, and now we need to execute that. So it's a really exciting time. So with our Series A funds, they take us from today through our FDA submission. So this will be an FDA-regulated product. It'll be prescribed. And we have a whole set of clinical work that we need to do in order to achieve that FDA approval. So this round covers us to pay for those studies and the submission and all the other work we need to do to make that happen.
I really admire tenacity. I've been following you for a while now. So how do you, you know, I'm sure there's ups and downs in your day. And sometimes, everything in life is just like, gosh, you know, why do I do this? I just like go pack up and do something else that's easier. But you keep at it. And what drive you?
Oh, that's a great question. So I usually say this is the most thrilling and terrifying thing I've ever done. So it's thrilling and terrifying daily.
But what thrills you and terrified you?
It's like thrilling parts are, you know, expanding our team, offering jobs to people, you know, who are excited to work on this, finding other people who are motivated to work on this, and talking to patients. I mean, helping to administer our clinical trials and meeting the participants was like just absolutely incredible. And hearing their comments at the end of the study and the thank yous they got. I mean, even just in interviews with women, you know, this is a quote I use often, but early days, I think before we had even started the company, one woman we interviewed, she said, "I know this is going to be really hard. So if ever you feel like giving up, can you just call me and I'll find somebody else to work on this?" And it was just like, oh my gosh, like we have to do this. Like that we are given a gift of this incredible opportunity, this idea we came up with, and all these women who are willing to participate. I mean, in our first clinical study, there was no benefit to the patient. It was purely data collection for us. And we still have women lining up to be in that study. And I just find that really moving.
How do you find those women? Do you go to work with the urogyn?
I personally hung paper flyers in Stanford's bathrooms. Literally, that's how we found our patients. We also had great physicians. We were working with a gynecologist oncologist at Stanford and a breast oncologist at Stanford. So they recruited patients as well. But I hung a lot of paper flyers.
That's interesting because your target market tend to be more of an older age, but Stanford tend to be younger.
Oh, it was Stanford Hospital.
Hospitals. Yeah. Okay,
so it was people who were coming through there. But okay. Yeah. So just, you know, that's what keeps me motivated to keep moving. And I think also a little bit of naivete helps. Like, I don't know what I don't know yet. And it's like, yeah, we just have to cross this, you know, this next bridge. Okay, now there's a mountain in front of us. Okay, we'll get over that. Okay, now there's another mountain. We'll get over that. And so
there's probably nothing terrifying you if you see it that way.
There's a lot of terrifying things. Like, we just recently hired a part-time CFO who makes my life so much easier because she can handle, I don't know anything about accounting. And I love math, but there's something about, you know, P&Ls and balance sheets where I just, my eyes start going glass, you know, glossing over. And I'm just like, Stacey, please help me. So,
well, yeah. That's good. So one thing that I always like to ask our guests is any books that they recommend. It's more like for my selfish reason. Then I, at least I got like, oh, that's a book that I'm going to read next.
Yeah. I guess a book that I just read that I loved was, I think a lot of people have actually recommended it to me, is The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. Have you heard of that one?
No, not that one.
So it's really short and it's, you know, a business book.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's written as a fable. So it's a fictional story about a woman CEO who comes in and helps a team kind of get back on their feet. And it goes through kind of the classic five dysfunctions of a team. And the minute I finished it, I was like, I just need to start this over. This was so good.
Do you see a lot of things that you can relate to? Like, yeah. What are they?
Yeah, well, one thing I remember specifically was that, you know, I'm someone who I've never enjoyed conflict. It's not something I prefer. I'm more of a kind of a peacekeeper type personality. And what the book kind of, I mean, I've learned this over time as well, but what the book really succinctly laid out was the importance of stepping into a conflict situation, because healthy conflict is actually very, very good and helps the business be better. And so I think that I've tried to apply that in conversations with, you know, my team or others about, okay, I can see that these two people are not aligned. And instead of just being like, okay, we'll talk about this later, it's like, oh, Christine, I see you're not, you know, fully communicating what you told me yesterday. Is there a reason you're not expressing your opinion? And try mm-hmm. to drag it out of people. So
Okay. That's
one thing I really liked. And I got to read it again. I don't know. There's a lot in there.
Well, at least there's five. So there's like four that you just have to remember five things. But this good. Five is something that easier to remember than 20 things. Okay.
And on my to-read list, I think everyone probably has this one too, is the Hard Thing About Hard Things.
Yeah.
I haven't read it yet. Have you?
No, it's on my list. I'm reading How Democracy Dies. I thought like it would be good to read something that, but then it's pretty scary. So I think I might go back to the business side of reading.
Yeah, this one will be a nice short break. It's really a short book.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, thank you for joining us. It's been really fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me.